Hello, this is Dan Lebatard. I was a baseball dork as a child. I would watch the line scores come across my television. That's how I was following Yankee games on television. Just the line scores. Every 3 minutes, the number would change, and I would find out whether the Yankees had scored in that top half of the inning or not.
You were lame.
I was super lame. I was 41 years old. I was also reading Bill James abstracts. And so, I figured I knew baseball. I thought that I knew baseball from being a child on. And then I picked up Moneyball by Michael Lewis. And he taught me about all sorts of things that I didn't know and how it is that the Oakland A's were exploring and exploiting, market inefficiencies. And so, that's how I discovered Michael Lewis, and Michael Lewis does that basically with any subject he decides to apply himself to. Even Malcolm Gladwell looks at Michael Lewis and says, I wish I could do it the way that he does it. All of that said, I really respect this guy for a number of different reasons. He's written books, Liar's Poker, about the financial world. He takes interesting subject matter and makes it more interesting. And so I enjoy talking to him. I remember, I think the last time we talked to him, he spent a few days with Barack Obama, and he was just, the details were extraordinary in that story. You can find it on the internet, but just what it was like to be around the nuclear football.
Yeah, he has a great story about how he was left alone with a nuclear football. And if you're a fan of Michael Lewis like Dan is, make sure to check out his podcast, Against the Rules with Michael Lewis.
Well, thank you, Mike. So while you're here, can you tell the people about the people who are sponsoring this so that our people, when they rate, subscribe, and review, they can also support our sponsors before we get to Michael Lewis.
Well, we mentioned Lewis's podcast, but we have a network here. You're listening to it. Lebatard and Friends, and the entire network is brought to you by Tissot. And this Father's Day, gift Dad a Tissot. Tissot is the official watch of the NBA. Again, the official watch of Lebatard and Friends, and the Tissot NBA collection offers different timepieces for all 30 teams. Plus, the newest addition, the Tissot Chrono XL NBA Collector, is made with official Spalding game ball leather. Every Tissot timepiece delivers quality performance and traditional luxury at an unbeatable price. Shop the Tissot collection at us.tissotshop.com and at select watch and jewelry stores nationwide. Tissot is also bringing our Lebatard and Friends live event to you, as is ZipRecruiter, who is bringing you this episode of South Beach Sessions. We tell you every week that hiring is challenging, but there is one place that you can go where hiring is made simple, fast, and smart, a place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't just stop there. This is how they go next level. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, South Beach Session listeners can try this service, this amazing ZipRecruiter service, for free by visiting the exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH. ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
So that keeps all this stuff free for you, all this podcast network stuff, everything that's coming at you from Lebatard and Friends, which we are still building out, that will include this New York trip that we're making here to do something that is going to become part fiasco and part extravaganza. We're growing out everything that we're doing here, and we ask you to support the sponsors who are supporting us, because that's what keeps it all afloat and will allow us to keep bringing you better and better stuff. We've got a assortment of writers in the coming weeks, Carl Hyacin, Dave Barry, some of my writer friends, but this guy, there is none better doing it in America in terms of exploratory journalism and explanatory storytelling. Michael Lewis, here he is. I don't think there is anyone who takes complicated subject matter and makes it bite-sized and digestible for a reading audience better than Michael Lewis has over the years, with a number of different projects that I want to talk to him about. He has a new podcast, Against the Rules. You should subscribe. New episodes are available weekly on iTunes. Michael, first of all, thank you for being on with us. I have been a big fan of yours since the first book of yours I picked up, which was Moneyball, and sort of changed the way that I looked at things. You do a great deal of that. Was that your big break, sort of teaching baseball about baseball?
I would say my big break was my first book was Liar's Poker, which was about my time working on Wall Street. I think that sort of set up the career. The money, where I think where Moneyball fits into my career is it gave me license after that to write about anything I wanted to, because it was such a departure from the sort of things I had written about, and there was some mild skepticism that I should be writing about sports. And when it worked, it meant that until I screw up anyway, I'm allowed to kind of go do what I want to do.
Well, what was your life? Liar's Poker was what, 1988, 1989?
In 89, right.
What was your life like right before that?
Well, when I published it, what was I? I was 28. I had some savings from working on Wall Street, and I was working as a freelance magazine writer. But, you know, I'd been working as a freelance magazine writer for the year since I'd left Wall Street. But I was so immersed in the writing of that book, and I was so idiotically sure it was going to work. I wasn't living in a state of anxiety or penury. I felt like this is all going to work out. Let's give it a whirl. And the interest in me writing, I mean, I had a handful of editors and magazines that would take my stuff, but after Liar's Poker, I could kind of write for who I wanted to, as long as I was sort of in and around the financial world.
But hold on a second. Explain this to me. Are you shitting me? You write Liar's Poker, you write it, and you have no doubts that that's going to be what's next for you. In your late 20s, oh, I'm going to be a successful author for sure. This will be easy.
Yeah, you know, that's what happens when you're 27, 28 years old, right? You think you're immortal. But what had set me up to feel that way was I had written several things about Wall Street while I was on Wall Street that had gotten a lot of attention, or what seemed to me to be a lot of attention. And so I did feel like the world would be interested in this story. As interested as it was, maybe not, but I did think the story would find an audience.
What draws you to that kind of subject matter? The Big Short, Liar's Poker, like what specifically is it about money or Wall Street that's most interesting to you?
Well, see, I think the thing about that was at the heart of Liar's Poker was, well, two things were going on. On the surface, I mean, I guess the big thing that's going on is you've got this financial sector becoming what we've come to know and love. I mean, it exploded and changed, and I was sitting in the middle of the change. But underneath that, the thing that really interested me was if anybody was going to pay me all that money to give financial advice, because I knew I didn't know anything. I mean, just how preposterous it was. And what attracts me to that place is just how distorted values are. You spend a lot of time talking about the sports world, and in the sports world, yeah, there are guys who get paid more than they should, and there are guys who don't get paid as much as they should. But it pales, and that the distortions are small in relation to a place like Wall Street, where you have, I mean, just people being paid out of all proportion to their value to the society. And that I think that's what energized me in the first place.
Well, you spent 20 years, correct me if I'm wrong, basically writing about this thread that fascinated you, which is how we value things in one way or another, right? Like you seem to gravitate at every turn, whether it's the blind side, anything else. Where can I see market inefficiencies? Where can I see things others don't? And then let me play with that.
That's true. I mean, there are things that there are books of mine and magazine articles of mine that don't really fit into that story. I wrote a little book about my high school baseball coach. I wrote a little book about fatherhood. They are The Undoing Project, the book about the two Israeli psychologists. Although that, I guess that does fit into it in a way. I mean, because they're explaining why we misvalue things. It is one of my great interests. And I think that it's an interest that's sort of near the center of our world, because we live in a market-driven world, and how markets value things is a very interesting subject.
And when did it become so for you? Like, why did it become so for you? Because you, one of the arts that you've crafted is you are really able to explain this stuff to idiots. You're able to explain it to us in a way that if it were complicated before, you read what you're writing and you say, wait a minute, why is this the only person writing this? Because some of the stuff should be obvious to others.
Well, if the question is how I first got interested in all this, I think that there are two things. One is I had an extremely happy childhood, which is normally a disadvantage for a writer. But I had an extremely happy childhood in essentially a dying society. I grew up in New Orleans, and the value system there was very different from the value system I encountered when I left it. I, in many ways, preferred the value system in New Orleans. And so that energizes me a bit, I think, when I hit Wall Street and I see that where money matters so much. It kind of unsettles me. But then the fact that I saw and I lived the experience of being misvalued myself in a very pleasant way. I mean, but the people were hurling money at me to do something I really shouldn't have been doing. I think that energized me. But the second part is like how you explain things to people and how you explain complicated things to people. And they're kind of two rules. One is I make myself explain it to my children or my wife or my mother before I write it, because that forces me to address an audience that doesn't know anything. And that's the big thing, I think, is getting yourself in a state of mind where you don't, even though you've learned it all, you're kind of back in a state of mind where you remember what it's like not to know anything. And the huge advantage of people who know things trying to explain it to people who don't know things is that they know the things, and they can't remember what it was like not to know them, so that they fail to sort of empathize with the person who they're talking to.
Do you, when writing about Wall Street, find yourself often appalled by the greed, corruption, or whatever it is that you're seeing that you're just like, this ain't right, man?
Yes. and it isn't that I dislike all Wall Street people. Some of my best friends work on Wall Street. But it's just a place where people get paid way more than they should for what they do. And in addition, it's also a place on top. It's always been that place. It's just gotten a bit worse. But on top of that, it's a place where people are incentivized to do things that are actively destructive, and made to feel like in doing them they're a big success because they get paid a lot of money. And these are things that they're not against the law. It's just like incentive systems are screwed up, and they drive people to behave in certain ways they just shouldn't.
What do you think is the most appalling thing about Wall Street
right now?
Yeah,
like what the story that I wrote in the book Flash Boys is still just an amazingly appalling story to me, and is part of this podcast actually. And it's that the heart of capitalism are these stock exchanges, and the stock exchanges in the last decade have ceased to be fair referees between buyers and sellers, and have got into the business, the very lucrative businesses of selling speed advantages to some of the players, so that high speed traders can exploit other people. And there's huge money in this, but it is an abdication of their essential responsibility, and that nobody is making more of a stink about it, although the SEC is just starting to make a stink about it, is amazing to me.
So explain to me why this is so poorly governed, because you've been in and out of this world. Why is it that this is something that you're finding things that should probably be regulated and be found by others?
It's not that I'm the only one who knows it. You know, the stories are hidden in plain sight. The problem is that when something breaks on Wall Street, think of it this way. You can think of Wall Street like this. Think of a giant oil pipeline running from Canada down to Houston. And someone comes along and knocks a hole in the pipeline somewhere in the Midwest, and oil gushes out of it. Not so much that some oil doesn't eventually reach Houston, but you have this gusher in the Midwest coming out of the side of this pipe. It's inefficient. It's kind of theft. But what happens? You know, if the person who knocks the hole in it is an honest, straightforward person without any kind of self-interest, they say, come fix it. But Wall Street people aren't like that. What they do is they build a little village around the hole, and they start to make lots of money off the oil coming out of the side of the pipe. And when people come in and try to police them or regulate them, they pay the regulators not to do so. And that's the big problem. The big problem is when a hole gets knocked in the side of the financial markets and people are making money in ways they shouldn't, they have the ability to go into the regulatory system with those vast sums of money and distort the regulation. Essentially, the regulator is owned by the people who are being regulated.
Which of your books was the most difficult to write?
The most difficult to write was The Undoing Project, because I was dealing with two people, the main characters, Amos Tversky and Danny Kahneman, two psychologists, who were so much smarter than I was. I sensed deep down that I was never going to be able to do them justice. So that was, it was a little scary. The most complicated thing to explain was in The Big Short, in the financial instruments at the heart of the financial crisis.
And when you say scary, what did scary look like?
Scary? You mean scary when I felt scared by my subjects?
Yes, you're scared by your subjects. You're sitting there and tackling a book. Every time I've talked to you about your book writing, I've envied that your process doesn't seem to be too pained. And so when you say that there's subject matter that you find scary because you can't rise to their level, I want to know what the nature of that fear looked like.
So I'll tell you first, the first symptom of this was how long it took me to write that book. I started it, I published it in, 2017, but I started working on it in 2008, and I wrote The Big Short, Flash Boys, I don't know what else, instead of writing it, because I kept putting it to one side. So I procrastinated horribly with it because I just kept thinking, no, I'm not the one to do this. In the writing of it, once I finally engaged with it, and there were reasons I finally engaged with it, it became clear that no one else was going to write it, and a lot of the people who were in the middle of it were dying off. So if I didn't write it soon, I'd never write it. Once I engaged with it, I ceased to be frightened. But it was just getting going with it that was the problem.
Well, help me understand and help the listener understand here, because you were doing how the mind screws with us, how you're basically writing about the brain, the human brain, you know, while with two of the smartest people you'll ever meet, right?
Yes. Two of the smartest people who are also actively hostile to the idea of story, which is what I'm telling, right? Because their arguments are essentially that the mind, instead of moving through the world and making the probabilistic calculations it should be making, even when there's just statistics available to make those calculations, instead what the mind does is it tells stories that are filled with all kinds of problems. And that I was going to approach them by telling a story that was no doubt filled with all kinds of problems. That was a certain inhibition.
Actively hostile how?
They were showing the way these stories we tell ourselves to make sense of the world around us have all these mistakes buried in them, systematic mistakes. And they were explaining in a funny way the story of Moneyball, like why baseball players get misvalued by people who are just eyeballing them. The fact that I was reducing them to a narrative, to a story, they would both, the one was not living, but I'm sure they would both say to me, yeah, it's a nice story, but the very act of telling the story is going to distort us.
Hmm. What did you learn about the brain that you found most fascinating? Or if you were explaining it to your kids and assuming they didn't understand, what are the things that you would point to?
If you want to be smarter in how you live your life, you really need to watch yourself and be aware of certain mistakes you'll always make. You'll always exaggerate risks that are really vivid, like catastrophe, remote catastrophes if they're really vivid and dramatic. And you'll always underestimate things that aren't dramatic or vivid. You'll think in stereotypes. Yes, it's bad to be bigoted and prejudiced and all that, but the fact is the brain is wired to think in kind of crude stereotypes. And so be aware of that. When you're hiring someone for a job, if the person looks the type, be wary of that. And similarly, if you don't like someone for a job because they don't look right in some way, be wary of that. Your mind is telling you to do things that you probably shouldn't.
The mind is a bit of a poison, yes?
The mind is a useful, crude tool. It's sort of like good enough for the job, but it makes these systematic mistakes, and if we're aware of those mistakes, we can use it better.
And what would you point to that you learned about your own brain that was actually helpful to improving your life? Because someone who has to spend as much time thinking as you must have difficulties turning off his brain.
I don't have any trouble at all turning off my brain. I'm about to do it in 5 minutes.
Okay, very good. I'm surprised you didn't do it 5 minutes ago, maybe bored by the questions.
You know, I'm sorry. I hate to disabuse you of your of your idea of me. No, I'm afraid I turn it off pretty easily. And I just said the single biggest thing is just how wary I am of my own stereotyping of people. I just back away. I try to ask myself why I think what I think. Not all the time. I'm too lazy to do it all the time. But it does occur. And I give you like a little metaphor for how it's affected my attitude towards risk. A concrete example that's also a metaphor. Like everyone else, when I'm out driving on the California freeways, when I see an accident, you know, and there's carnage on the highway, I'm much more careful as a driver for the next, you know, 30 minutes. When it's actually, that's probably the safest time, right after everybody's seen an accident, and everybody's a little more careful. So now I make an effort to be a lot more careful when it seems like the situation is trouble-free, when it's sunny and there's no obvious threats. And that's, I think, you know, you're sort of like you're in the idea that you're at most risk when you're not aware of the risk. I kind of internalized that as a result of that book.
So you listen to fear?
Yeah, I do. Fear is a funny thing because you get scared when you see the carnage on the highway. And that's when you probably should be the least scared because the bad things happened. It's like when nothing bad has happened for a long time is when you need to be most worried.
Which of your books would you point to and say, that one surprised me? I was writing it for this reason, and then it became that.
That's really interesting. I think maybe The Blind Side, that surprised me in this, just the richness of the subject. And which of the books surprised me in that it took me in a direction I didn't expect? It's a hard question because by the time I actually sit down to write, I have so thoroughly plotted the thing that the surprise doesn't happen once the writing starts. It happens on the level of the sentence and the level of the paragraph, but the story doesn't usually change.
Take me through it, though. So The Blind Side, you are writing, you're, again, gravitating toward market inefficiencies, value, how we value things. You find a left tackle whose story, you wanted to write about the left tackle. You didn't go in thinking to write the story of Michael Orr, right?
It surprised me how good a story there was in a place I wasn't looking for a book. Sean Toohey, who is the dad in The Blind Side, Tim McGraw played him in the movie, who's the white father who adopts the black child, was my school classmate from age 5 to 18. And I just happened, I hadn't seen him since high school, and I happened to be in Memphis, and I visited him. And in his living room is this, you know, 300-pound, 6-foot-4-inch, 15-year-old illiterate black child. He's just taken in. And I didn't think I was going to write a book about my childhood friend. It was bizarre that it just kind of mushroomed. And then, but I had at the same time been talking to the San Francisco 49ers front office about what had happened to the distribution of money on the football field and seen this weird thing that since free agency had been the birth of free agency, the left tackle's pay had skyrocketed. And then it turns out this boy in my friend's living room is, you know, projected as a future first-round draft pick left tackle because he has all the attributes of a left tackle at the age of 17. And then all of a sudden there's a story about it. It's not just about football. It's about all the forces in the world that affect the value of this boy. And one of them is football and football strategy, and another is the fact he has a mother all of a sudden. So in terms of being surprised by a story, that was the biggest surprise because, you know, it really is. It never occurred to me that I'd be writing about someone from my past that way.
You are thorough. You are caring. You're going to take a great care writing about someone from your past. Were you hurt by Michael Orr not liking the movie?
He moved in stages on this subject. The book obviously preceded the movie by several years. And he seemed to like the book all right. And so that was the important thing to me. And then with the movie, it was complicated because the people who made the movie got rich. I mean, they made it for $30 million, and they grossed $500 million. And Michael Orr didn't see a nickel of that, or hardly a nickel of that. And I think that partly informed his hostility to the movie. But I think also what informed his hostility to the movie was not the movie itself, but the reaction of some of the football players to the movie. I mean, they got teased about it. So it was a little hard to know how deeply off-put he was by the movie itself as opposed to these other things. Having said all that, I really liked Michael, and I really wanted him to be happy. And I was a little sad that he didn't take more pleasure in it because I think he could have gotten a lot of pleasure from it if he'd viewed it a different way. But the movie, having said all that, the movie isn't me. You know, the movie's not my book. It's other people doing this thing. So I didn't feel all that responsible for the movie.
So cocky 20-plus you isn't imagining that his books are ever going to turn into movies, The Big Short, right? You're not even the cockiest you is expecting that.
Well, you know, it's funny. Liar's Poker was bought instantly, and I thought, yeah, why not? And all these different people were said they're going to play me, and Marlon Brando was going to play John Goodfriend, and the writers were writing it, and I thought, oh, this is, and then it didn't happen. And then for years and years and years, books and magazine articles would get bought by the movies, and I began to view the movie industry as this machine for throwing money at me for no good reason. And so I did just kind of give up on the idea that these were ever going to be movies, and I didn't care all that much. And then all of a sudden, The Blind Side happens, and kind of accidentally. I mean, the movie industry would not have made The Blind Side. The Blind Side got made after every movie studio rejected it as not commercial. And Fred Smith, the founder of FedEx, who lived down the street from the Tuies in Memphis and whose son was dating their daughter, who watched the whole story in real time, said, that's a great story. I'll pay for the movie to be made, but I'm going to do it on a shoestring, and made everybody look like a fool. And so that changed my relationship to the movie industry, because all of a sudden then people said, maybe there's something in these books.
Last time I had talked to you was you had spent time with Obama, and you got all the details. It was really well reported. But beyond that, I remember you seeming to really enjoy doing that. When you think of your projects, joy and joy in the process, is there one that stands out?
Like, is more pleasurable than all the rest.
Just enjoying the doing of it.
They're all pretty fun. Even if they're hard in places, they're all joyous experiences. But I got to say that of all of them, Moneyball was a real pleasure in that, because I played the game. The game, it meant so much to me, but I hadn't really paid all that much attention to it. And I got to dive back in and be on the edge of this thing that was clearly more important than just baseball. There was a thrill to that that was peculiar.
Tell me about it, though, because this is primarily a sports audience, and it was my introduction to you, because I was reading a book. Keep in mind, I grew up on Bill James' Baseball Abstract, so I didn't think I was an idiot, but I'm reading your book, and I'm like, oh, I didn't know this, I didn't know this, I didn't know this, and just page after page, I didn't know this, and it felt like baseball read it the same way.
Well, those feelings you had, I had those feelings as I was marinating in the front office of the Oakland A's. So I had had all those same sensations. And I think baseball had obviously had a hostile reaction to it at first. It was quite threatening to most of the people who were in front offices and scouts and all the rest, and everybody was angry at me. I didn't get the sense that baseball people were picking up my book and saying, wow, he's really taught me something. I think they picked up my book and said, who's this idiot I've never heard of who's saying that we're not running our franchise well? That was the first reaction of baseball insiders. The owners had a different reaction. I mean, the reason I think the book gained traction was I had an audience, you know, with the kind of people who own baseball teams from the financial books. And they read the book, or their friends read the book, and called the friends who ran the teams and said, you're being screwed by the people who are running the team. And then you started to see transformation in the front offices, which was cool. I mean, it's interesting.
You started that. Like, Billy Beane started it, but you started it by reporting all of it, because that was a seismic change in the entire landscape where we realized, oh, everyone's been doing the measurements wrong. But when you say people were angry with you, what do you remember about the hostility? Who were the names that are calling you names?
It was scouts who felt threatened and their friends who were kind of beat writers, Baseball America type writers, who felt insulted. It didn't much matter. In fact, it probably was good for the book that there was some controversy right from the beginning and that people weren't just all so happy with it. And the truth is, if you write anything that's going to at all meaningful, you're going to tick off somebody. The deeper truth, I think, was, yeah, the book maybe accelerated this change in the sport, but I was only a step ahead of what was happening. The Boston Red Sox had just been bought by John Henry, and he was trying to hire Billy Beane to come do for him what he'd done for Oakland, and was going to do it one way or the other. And I think if I had not written the book, the main effect would be for the Boston Red Sox and not the Oakland A's to have gotten the credit for revolutionizing the sport.
Well, Theo Epstein used all of your principles, right? I don't know where he got them from. I find interesting, though, what you're saying. So baseball owners have enough money and know you're writing because you're writing smartly about the financial game. And so they realize, wait a minute, I'm paying my baseball staff to largely be idiots.
Yes. To mismanage my resources. In addition, the backdrop to all this is the kind of person who's owning a sports franchise is changing. He's becoming a tech guy or a finance guy, people who are kind of comfortable with data and analytics. And so they're open to this new way of thinking about it because it's a way they can compete when they're in the room with the people who know the sport. So I think that there was an openness on the part of these people to this kind of message. And that is how it changed. I mean, that's how the way change happened was through the owners. Owners either firing existing management or buttressing them with data geeks. And all of a sudden, they're jobs in the industry for people who previously were not welcome.
Explain to me, like, in terms of satisfying and fulfilling, when you look over a landscape and realize you've changed it or contributed to changing it, where does it rank in terms of fulfillment? You were talking about people hurling money at you. I'm gathering that it probably means more in terms of fulfillment to watch baseball change, at least in part, because of something you wrote.
I don't look at what's happening and think I had much to do with it because there's so many other, you know, Billy Beane had to do what he did, and Bill James had to do what he did, and I was just, I was one stop in the story. But, I mean, I guess it's still going on in a way, but the revolution is over. The revolutionaries have won. But when it was all happening, it was cool to flip on the television and hear people shouting about my book during baseball games. I thought that was just great. At some point, I wearied of Joe Morgan trashing the book wherever he could, and I would just turn off the volume and watch the games without the announcers. But for a while, it was just kind of cool to be part of the conversation, a conversation that, in which I was really an interloper. It was fun.
I remember thinking to myself, though, as Joe Morgan was trashing you, and I think he may have even admitted it, that he hadn't even read the book, that you were basically attacking things he believed in, and he believed in those things because he had the ego to see them. He didn't need your explanations.
Yeah, no, it was a fairly common refrain. The book's stupid. I'm not reading it, is what they would say. The book doesn't make any sense. I'm not reading it. I mean, it isn't the nature of sports to have honest intellectual engagement. I wasn't expecting it, and they didn't deliver it.
Is there any place where you've written a book, because you've talked about some discomforts here, but the reaction became deeply uncomfortable? I guess I'm asking you, what was the most uncomfortable experience you had to endure because of something you've written?
Flash Boys, because it was like Moneyball in that it was threatening an established order. And but in this case, the people on who it was threatening were billionaires and were high-frequency traders and who were basically at the heart of the financial system. And that was the one case where the people whose business was threatened actually generated, at great expense, essentially a hostile political campaign aimed at the book, a propaganda campaign, hiring people to attack the book. And that was upsetting because what it really did is it gummed up the possibility of change. The kind of change that happened after Moneyball should have happened after Flash Boys, and the money stopped it from happening.
Wow. Tell me more about that. Explain to me how that happened, because I didn't know that part of it, that basically you're telling us that the billionaires bought the ability.
The exchanges have gotten rigged, and rigged in a very subtle way that leads to billions of dollars being transferred from essentially, you know, middle-class American savings into the pockets of rich, high-frequency traders. And those firms and traders spent a lot of money on politicians and on regulators, hiring people out of the SEC, donating to political campaigns, hiring academics to publish work that supposedly debunks my own, that kind of thing. When you muddy the waters sufficiently and you're asking politicians to take on rich interests at the same time, they won't do it because it's a complicated subject. The easier thing to do is stay friendly with the people who give you money for your political campaigns. So they were just able to just stop things from changing. Whereas in baseball, it was much cleaner and more open. There wasn't organized assault on the book. And the truth is that the people who had money, in the end, had an interest in embracing the message of the book because it saved them money.
When and how did you realize that there was an orchestrated assault on the book?
When Flash Boys came out, the organization was created in Washington in response to it. And I got sent memo. I don't know, reporters dug out memos between that organization and high-frequency traders that were paying the organization to trash the book. I mean, it was just like, if you go back and look at the press around Flash Boys, you can see it happening. And the protagonists of the book, the people who created the Fair Exchange, it's called the IEX, the Investors Exchange, were on the receiving end of the same sort of stuff, and they had the resources to find out who was doing things to them. And so they just accumulated files. And it was a professional hit job. It was done in the same way a politician would organize an attack of a rival politician. It was that kind of thing.
What was the worst of it?
The worst of it was simple. The worst was this thing that everybody needs to hear and this thing that needs to be fixed won't be heard and it won't be fixed. It was like it neutered the power of the book to change the system quickly.
Before that, what was the worst of it? Because it doesn't sound like you had any fear. It sounds like you noticed this happening in real time and were like, oh, look, they're going to be able to nuke this.
Well, I mean, you know, people threaten lawsuits. That wasn't actually all that miserable. Unlike the protagonists of my books had physical threats, they had to hire security. They were made really uncomfortable. As the author, you're sort of the chicken at the ham and eggs breakfast, right? And they're the pig. The pig's all in, and the chicken's kind of interested. I didn't fear for my life or anything like that. I didn't feel that way about it. But it was just like, it's not nice waking up and having yourself trashed in the newspaper for things that you know are true. It's disturbing to see a very simple story, once you understand it, get distorted in ways that make it impossible for the public to digest it.
Malcolm Gladwell has said of you, and I'm sure you've heard this quote, I read Lewis for the same reason I watch Tiger Woods. I'll never play like that, but it's good to be reminded every now and again what genius looks like. You might pshaw that, I don't know, but when Malcolm Gladwell, a modern-day intellectual, says that about you, and he is someone who is very good at taking complicated ideas and making them understandable, you thought what when you heard that?
I thought, Malcolm has the ability to make people feel more loved than they should. And I thought he was lavishing praise on me that I didn't completely deserve. But that was really nice of him. I think it's a better description of him than me. I think he actually does have an almost superpower in an ability to take ideas and make them interesting to people. I think what I'm doing is a little bit more old-fashioned. I think I'm taking people and making them interesting to people.
Do you think he's better at that? Is that what I just heard you say?
He's better at taking ideas and making them swing on the page, absolutely. Far more of an intellectual than I am. Far more fun to watch play with just an idea. I do things he doesn't do. I mean, I do sustain a narrative in a way he's not that interested in doing. That's an old-fashioned and in some ways less interesting skill.
Hmm. We've had Adam McKay on our show. Love his work. Love how creative he is.
And he's the best.
Oh, he's really a smart dude. And then he decides he's going to direct The Big Short because he picked up your book, he told us, at like 9 one night, and then 7 o'clock in the morning, he's still reading it, and his wife's walking in and saying, what are you doing? How did you learn? Because The Big Short seemed like it was going to be really hard to make a movie about that. In fact, I can't imagine a movie about that until having seen it. It wouldn't have worked to me on a script.
You're absolutely right. And I didn't imagine either. And my reaction when the film rights were first purchased was, you're insane. I don't know how you're going to do this. But when they said he was going to do it, I knew him from Talladega Nights. I thought, that's exactly who has a chance, because he has the capacity to make everything entertaining. And if you can entertain the audience, they'll follow you places. And that's his trick, right? He's never boring. The screen's just exploding. And you want to kind of be with him and hear what he has to say, and you'll let him break all kinds of rules as he's trying to tell you things, because you basically trust him as a storyteller. So, yes, I'm forever grateful to him for bringing that story to such an audience.
What would you tell us was the most interesting stuff you uncovered as you gravitated over to Silicon Valley? Because you do end up in places where there are giant amounts of money.
Yeah, that's true. I wrote one book about Silicon Valley, The New Thing, and I guess I published that in maybe 2001. And it was at the heart of that book is a character named Jim Clark, who's sort of the original internet entrepreneur in some ways. He sort of embodied the spirit of the place in all kinds of ways. My biggest takeaway from Silicon Valley was it's a very, very, very hard place to write a story about, because it's always plowing itself under. You know, it's all about displacing what just happened. And it moves so fast that nothing has time, like story doesn't have time to develop. You know, there's a really good first chapter, but then it goes nowhere. It's a frustrating place to try to turn into a narrative. But that was the early internet age. And he'd been there before then. I could write the story through him because he had this whole prehistory back when the Valley was a more stable place.
So I was watching this documentary. Help me understand something as someone who comes from that time. Did you see the Theranos documentary on HBO?
I did.
Okay, so just to tell the audience, basically it's just fraud of the highest order. I don't even know how in fact, you're better with words than I am. Why don't you explain to the audience what the hell that's about, because I don't have the dexterity of Silicon Valley language.
I have not read the book Bad Blood, on which it's, I think, basically based, but female entrepreneur / sort of scientist Elizabeth Holmes claims to have a new gizmo to draw blood from people to make testing much simpler, easier, do it at home, and you can find out much more about your whatever is inside of you than you could before, and it's a total con. And that she persuades hundreds of millions of dollars and lots of famous, important people to support her, and fools the world for 4 or 5 years. The joke of the story is that this environment will tolerate that. And it was just a con from the beginning. She had no ability to do this, and everybody should have known it. And it was probably an open secret, but nobody had an interest in revealing it.
But how? How does something like that happen? I mean, you understand how that happens?
How does it happen? Well, she was using famous people to make herself reputable. These people had the kind of people who she attracted to her had no independent ability to evaluate her technology. And she seemed to be very good at keeping away from her anybody who had an actual ability to evaluate the technology. People were in love with the idea of it and in love with the idea of her, and they wanted to believe.
This guy here is as good as it gets when it comes to writing during my lifetime. You want to subscribe to his new podcast. It's called Against the Rules. New episodes are available weekly on iTunes. What is it that lured you to having these conversations on podcasts? What is Against the Rules?
It's a 7-episode, it's narrative. It's essentially a book in the form of a podcast about the referees in American life. And what caught my interest in the first place was sports referees and how their mistakes are ever more scrutinized and ever more likely to generate huge amounts of outrage at the same time that they are being hired and trained and prepared and checked much more professionally. They've generally got to be more accurate than they ever were, and they're more loathed and treated and more abused than they ever were. And that's the first episode is about NBA refs, but then it just goes off to examine referees in other walks of American life, judges, regulators, so on and so forth.
People who make value judgments is basically
people whose job it is to enforce the rules and ensure fair play and make the world feel fair. And just how under attack the general thrust of the story is. Wherever there's a human being who's trying to enforce fairness, that human being is under attack.
That's interesting. What lured you to it?
A whole bunch of things, but probably the biggest inciting incident was watching the Trump and Bernie Sanders campaigns in 2016 and how both of them were getting their energy from the argument that the world's now rigged, various systems are now rigged, and the feelings of unfairness that they were tapping into. Got me thinking about this subject generally.
Huh, that's pretty cool. Michael, always appreciate your curiosity. Thank you for lending some time to us. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dan.
Our thanks to Michael Lewis for joining us. He really is one of the most interesting authors I've ever read in America. Not that I'm the most literary of people, but he has taught me a good amount of things about things that I didn't know. He made them interesting. So our thanks to him. We'll have him on again in the future. Mystery Crate is not going to be appearing this week because we are headed to New York, and we're going to try this possible fiasco situation where we ask a whole lot of people for money, and we don't totally know what we're doing yet, but we're going to do that on Saturday. So some of the normal podcast schedule is going to be disrupted, but you could check out Sarah Spain. That's What She Said. Mina Kimes with her dog Lenny. Marty Smith's America. We will be back when we get back from New York after doing this, again, fiasco and terror stricken. The night will be dark and full of terrors for everyone around here as we head to New York, but we will talk to you when we get back.